Okay, thank you. So I have to say that having prepared these slides a little in a rush, they might be slightly too long because I didn't have the time to trim them down, probably to make this completely contained in an hour. So at worst, I will skip the last section, and if you're interested, you can just ask me and I can email you the slides. So let me start by discussing the problem. So the topic is the quasi-local degrees of freedom of Yang-Mills theory. And Florian some last year, and it's mostly based on the paper that we put out a few months ago. So let me start by giving a sense of what the problem at hand is. So gauge theories and localities have like a conflictual relationship, and this is most easily seen probably by focusing on the Gauss constraint. In fact, this is the source of all the problems in a sense. And the Gauss constraint is really the defining feature of a gauge theory. So in this case, I just use as an example electromagnetism, and we have the divergence of the electric field giving the electric charge density. So due to this constraint that must be satisfied at all times, it cannot be freely specified point by point because the electric field has to satisfy this equation, which is essentially an elliptic equation, and therefore tells us that, again, the initial data cannot be specified field. So how does this non-locality interact with boundaries is easily seen by focusing, for example, on the electrostatic field of a point charge, which we see is this 1/r² field is bound to leak outside of any region, and due to the Gauss law, we know that we can detect the presence of the charge no matter how far away we are from it, as long as we can encircle the region. So this pink cloud is pictorially representing the dressed electron. I'm calling dressed the electron together with its electrostatic field. So another viewpoint on the stratum and observables are not point-like, but extended object, even forgetting about point charges. If we think of Yang-Mills, we know that Wilson loops are the fundamental variables, and these are extended, and of course some of them will lie half in and half outside of any region R that we are considering, and so we should ask what is happening to them when they cross the boundary. A very similar kind of an in-between situation is lattice gauge theory, where the problems arise because in a way, we are condensing, like from a loop gravity perspective, this is very natural, of course. All the degrees of freedom are encoded into some finite set of Wilson lines that intersect at vertices and so on. And when we go across a boundary, these actually get cut in two. And what happens at the open ends is the question there. And as it is well known, if we cannot impose the Gauss constraint at an open edge, because we would just lose the information on that edge. So I don't think I will have a lot of time to explain why, but I think the lattice perspective is misleading in providing the answers to the question. And this is somehow best interpreted from the perspective I will put forward as a very complicated one-dimensional manifold. And so there is somehow a difference between treating the continuum theory and treating the discretized one. So I hope if I forget to come back to this and you're interested, please ask a question at the end. Okay. So this was just to set up the stage. We have seen that gauge invariant degrees of freedom are not point-like. And since we identify quasi-local degrees of freedom associated to regions rather than to points. So and this is what they would call quasi-local. So degrees of freedom that are associated to a region with boundary rather than to a single point, because that we know already is not, it's not really possible. And what happens at the boundary of these regions, of course, is the point of interest. So I will phrase these these questions in terms of the cutting and sewing problem. So the cutting problem is the following, which it asks how we can take our global state and cut and think of it in terms of within a finite region. So which kind of degrees, gauge invariant degrees of freedom can we localize within the region, and whether they are enough to determine the physics in the causal domain of R. So this is influenced by the electrostatic field of charges outside this region. So there must be some information encoding those charges. And so in that sense, the quasi-local degrees of freedom are not, strictly speaking, enough to determine the physics in the causal domain. We will see which information we have to add, of course. And the second part is, once we have identified the gauge invariant degrees of freedom inside each bounded region, we want to know how to sew them together or glue them together, and whether and what kind of information do we need to reconstruct the full configuration on the union of these regions. So I, of course, will start from the cutting problem in the first part of the talk and then focus on the sewing part. But let's, so in another way, before getting into that, I just want to mention another way to detect that there is a problem with locality, and this time I want to focus on the charges of a gauge theory. So a crucial fact about the charges of a gauge theory, understood as the symplectic generators of the gauge symmetry, is the fact that they must vanish on shell. And the reason this happens is that these charges are, of course, related to the constraint, to the Gauss constraint. So this reflects the fact that these charges vanish identically on shell of the constraint tells us in mathematical terms that gauge is essentially fluff that does not carry any physical information. Whereas, for example, the charge for the angular momentum doesn't vanish, and in fact is different values and encode different properties of the physical system. So that's in that sense. So, but what happens when we add boundaries? So in this case, the electric charge is not given just by the Gauss constraint, because the two are related by an integration by part, if one is careful. And we see that even on shell of the Gauss constraint, we're left with a boundary term that essentially encodes a smearing of the electric flux. So, and this, of course, doesn't need to vanish, not only in the presence of charges, but since the smearing is arbitrary, even in the absence of local charges. So the usual conclusion is that we should define gauge transformation as those gauge parameters that vanish at the boundary. I say usual in the sense that this is what you find, especially in older literature, and is somehow the least painful procedure if you want to cut corners a little bit. So, but of course, this leaves open the question of how to interpret the boundary value of this gauge transformation, and especially how to interpret these non-vanishing charges. So I will get back to the charges at the very end of the talk, and this is probably the part I will have to skip for lack of time. But I think this is still useful to remember, and especially it allows me to mention this fact, that's what happens in the case we decide to define gauge transformation in this more restrictive way as vanishing at the boundary. So to revisit this idea, let me talk about gauge fixing. And I want to consider the Coulomb gauge fixing because it will be useful for later. So if I would decide that I'm happy with gauge fixing my my gauge potential in with Coulomb gauge, and what I call Coulomb gauge is a divergence-free condition, then I'm happy if there is no boundary because I just look at this Coulomb condition and you realize that the I can uniquely define the gauge fixed potential in terms of the non-gauge fixed one because I can extract the gauge part by solving this Laplace equation, this Poisson equation, sorry. So, and this Poisson equation has a unique solution in the region exactly because there are no boundaries, or maybe I put strong enough Olof conditions at infinity, something like that. Now, in the presence of a boundary, of course, this Poisson equation is not enough. I have to solve it, I have to require some sort of boundary condition for the gauge part. So the standard solution that I mentioned before consists in asking that the gauge part vanishes at the boundary. But then a gauge transformation of this form where Xi doesn't vanish at the boundaries, but is his Laplacian is zero in the bulk, cannot be gauge fixed. So these kind of configurations, I'm forced to consider them as different. So are these new physical degrees of freedom? These size that appear like this, that rise at the boundary? Well, I want to take a different route. And somehow, I don't want to go down this way. I want to try to understand whether at least, in a sense, whether a better gauge fixing exists. So before starting with the actual content of the talk, let me say a couple of words about how am I thinking about boundaries. So when talking about boundaries, I have in mind virtual or fiducial boundaries. These of the kind that arise when I think of cutting and gluing a manifold with fields living on top, or maybe what is happening at the black hole or cosmological horizon where there is no actual physical interface put there. So this also means that since my approach will be valid for fiducial boundaries, in fact, will be compatible with any sort of boundary conditions that you would like to impose at a second time. Physical boundary, in the case of physical boundaries, of course, they are always defined by adding extra degrees of freedom, but there is no mystery in this case. For example, if I have a metal plate, there will be electrons living on it and so on. Of course, a lot is known in particular for Chern-Simons theory in the context of what happens at boundaries, but Chern-Simons theory is pretty different from Young-Mills theory, and I will be focusing only on Young-Mills and Maxwell theories in this talk. And I will say what makes them different when the occasion arises. Okay, so let's get into the, if there are no questions, let me get into the core of the talk. So here in this part, I will build the tools needed to answer the cutting and sewing problem. Okay, so the tools that I want to use arise when we decide to combine three types of geometries. So we have this, let me start from the bottom. So at the bottom, we have the geometry of spacetime. So this is the most obvious geometry that we have encountered, and this answers somewhat the questions of what is locality. Then we have the geometry of fiber bundles on the top right corner. So fiber bundles are the mathematical structures that arise when we ask what is the geometrical meaning of gauge. And finally, when we want to talk about degrees of freedom and understand degrees of freedom, we need to talk about symplectic geometry of the space of field configurations. So it turns out that if we put together these three types of geometry, and take each of them seriously, we obtain something pretty interesting. So let me start from the top. So if we combine symplectic geometries and geometry of fiber bundle, here thought as the I will explain that later. So if we combine these two, what we can define is a gauge covariant symplectic geometry on the space of gauge field configurations. But this is not yet enough to answer our questions, because a lot of ambiguities exist in the way we can choose a connection on the fiber bundle. There is no natural choice of a connection on a fiber bundle. So there is still a huge arbitrariness that doesn't help to solve our problems. But when we combine these with the geometry that is given us by space-time itself, then we find a unique connection form on the space of field configurations, which essentially encodes the answer to, this is what I want to convince you about, the answer to the cutting and sewing problem. So I will explain all these in more detail, but the idea is that combining these three types of geometries gives us a unique object that allows us to solve the cutting and sewing problem and define what quasi-local gauge invariant degrees of freedom are for Young-Mills theory. So this is not something that is, not everything is in this map is completely new. And in fact, this framework combines ideas and in fact develop further ideas that have appeared in the last 50 years, from Dirac dressing of the electron to the Grebov Singer problem and work by Wilkowiecki and DeWitt, and also by Laurent and William and many others. Okay, so let's go back to this gauge fixing. So here, of course, I will try to present things a bit backwards. So I will not show you how to combine these three things, but rather try to argue my way through to the conclusion and then tell you to the answer and then tell you where it's coming from. So for this reason, it's useful to go back to the Coulomb gauge. And now let me introduce a new boundary condition. So I'm not asking, let's see what the condition was. Here the condition was of the standard solution was a Dirichlet condition on the Poisson problem around here. But now what I'm asking is rather a Neumann boundary condition, which is field dependent. And this field dependence essentially ensures complete covariance of the construction. And in particular, it translates to a gauge fixing condition at the boundary for the magnetic potential A gauge fixed. So in the following, I will not use the gauge fix label anymore. I will call this radiative degrees of freedom. And the reason is because these degrees of freedom somehow generalize the notion of a transverse photon to a finite region. So this gauge fixing is complete, including at the boundary. It can reabsorb any gauge transformation except for the global U1. And this is a feature, not a problem, as I will explain. As I plan to explain in the part that I will never get to. But the point is that all gauge ambiguities can be completely fixed thanks to this new boundary condition for the gauge part or for the Coulomb part, depending on the perspective. So, of course, this is nice, but it doesn't, why this choice and not something else? So the reason why this choice is privileged is the following. It is because it's coming from this geometrical construction at the level of field space. So let's start from the geometries of the space of gauge potentials A, and let's perform on it in Helmholtz decomposition. So the Helmholtz decomposition takes some some one form and decomposes it into a part that is divergence free and a pure gradient part, which is exactly what we want to do. For reasons that will be clear later, we also have to change perspective a little bit and not think about gauge fixing, but rather about gauge fixings of perturbations. So in a sense, what I'm doing from now on will be working at the level of tangent spaces of the configuration space. So in the picture, here we have a tangent space and the point, and I'm considering vectors on top of that. So we have delta A, which is given by delta A, the radiative part, plus a pure gradient part. So the Helmholtz decomposition can be understood as an orthogonal decomposition on this space with respect to a natural ultra-local supermetric. So this metric, as you see, contains the geometry of space. So we have not only the metric of space, but also the fact that there is a region R and its boundary. Now, what we want is that the radiative mode, delta A rad, so this is what we call the radiative mode, is orthogonal to all possible gauge modes, which are this gradient of xi. And asking that this is true even at the boundary give us automatically both the bulk condition and the boundary condition, which are, oh, sorry, here S should be N. So this is just by integrating by part this expression. So by construction, this automatically provides both a bulk gauge fixing for delta E and a complete boundary condition. So how in electromagnetism, it is immediate to see that one can integrate this infinitesimal condition to a finite condition. It won't be as easy in Young-Mills. So, but before moving to Young-Mills, let's stay with Maxwell for a moment. And I want to add now an extra bit of information, which is the fact that the configuration space can be thought as an infinite dimensional fiber bundle. And on this fiber bundle, we can define a connection 1-4. And the fact is that these, what I was calling here just var pi, these omega bar, we call it var pi because it's the Latin LaTeX common for it. So this object, in fact, is secretly defining for us one such connection 1-4. So in electromagnetism, it's not so obvious. It's kind of trivial, but it will be non-trivial in the non-abelian theory. So from now on, I will think of var pi as a one form on configuration space valued in the algebra of gauge transformations. So it's in electromagnetism, Li of G is just a function on the region. Otherwise it will be valued in a function a Lie algebra function valued, sorry, a Lie algebra valued function on the region. Now, this is quasi-local. So from my configuration, from my perturbation delta A, I can construct var pi quasi-locally within R without using any data from outside that region. This perspective in terms of a connection form is actually very powerful. And I will say about, of course, I will say more about this later. So moving to the non-abelian theory, up to now, you can convince yourself that all you need to do is to change the partial derivative with the covariant derivative. Now, the subtlety is that this covariant derivative involves A, not delta A. So what is this A? This A is the base point that you've chosen on configuration space. So A is kind of a background configuration and delta A are perturbations around it. They are first order perturbations. There is no delta A square. This is differential geometry on the tangent space. So the important difference is that in the non-abelian case, this connection has a curvature, a functional curvature. So it's curved in field space. And this is the equation the curvature satisfies. This F is the curvature. And we see that when the commutator vanishes, this vanishes. And this is why in Young-Mills, we cannot integrate these structures to finite gauge fixing by maintaining the covariance of the construction. Because the presence of curvature in field space looks roughly like this. It means that these horizontal, what I will call horizontal spaces, which are the spaces spanned by delta A rad. So these horizontal spaces that are not along the fibers, not along the gauge directions, but orthogonal to them, form a distribution that it is not non-integrable because of the curvature. So the curvature measures the non-integrability of the distribution. So there is no such thing as a global gauge fixing associated to this connection. This is related to the Grebov-Singer problem. In fact, this connection was introduced by Singer without boundaries. The boundaries are new. Exactly to discuss the Grebov problem. So, and this is what makes subtle to integrate or impossible, depending on, is subtle in a neighborhood of your base configuration, it can be, it generally become impossible if you try to go too far from the base point. To integrate the condition on delta A to a gauge fixing for A itself. So the crucial fact is that all I will tell you from now on, in fact, will descend from the properties of this connection, which I will call the Singer-DeWitt connection on field space. So everything will follow just from this simple formula that you see up on this slide. Okay. So let's see how the math of this geometry talks to the physics. So the functional, now that we have a connection, we can define a covariant differential in field space. So this covariant differential in field space is actually giving us the variation of the transverse photon automatically. In Young-Mills, there is no such thing as I was emphasizing, a covariantly transverse gluon, not non-perturbatively. So this differential still exists, but is not exact. So in electromagnetism, I could write just delta A rad on the right-hand side, but in Young-Mills, I use this slash to denote that this differential is not exact. It's still a one form, but is not an exact differential. So here we start seeing how the geometry talks to the physics. And if we now go and study what happens to the electric field, we have more nice surprises. So if you apply the Helmholtz decomposition to the electric field, and here I need to say one note, to stress one point, what we're doing is to think of the electric field as a vector on the configuration space for the gauge potential. So the electric field is somehow the velocity A dot. So in that sense, it's naturally identified as a vector. And as such, I can decompose it into the two directions. This doesn't mean that the direction along the fibers for the electric field is gauge. No, because for example, in electromagnetism, the electric field is, there's no gauge component to it. So that's why I'm slightly changing the language. And now I talk not about gauge, but about the coulombic part. So it's the longitudinal part is the part along the fibers in this sense. It might be a little confusing. So if you were confused, just take this formula for granted and don't think about its geometry too much. So if you apply the Helmholtz decomposition to E, we find that it splits E into a transverse part and the longitudinal part. The longitudinal part is the coulombic piece and the transverse part is just the time derivative of the radiative mode. So again, there is no such thing as an irradiative gluon non-perturbatively, but what I mean is the contraction of this expression with the vector field defining the time flow in configuration space. So since there is the dot, this object is still well defined also in Young-Mills. I use this notation to emphasize the fact that this is a purely radiative piece and which is separated from the Coulombic one. And both are physical components in the case of the electric field. And since the radiative part is divergence-less, it means that it's only the Coulombic part that has to satisfy the Gauss law, the longitudinal part. And what is interesting here is that this Gauss law now naturally acquires not only a bulk piece, because of course the Laplacian of the phi of the Coulombic potential should be given by the electric charge, but we also have a boundary piece because we are on a finite region. And so this boundary is given by the electric flux. And I think it's often useful to think of this electric flux as an analog of rho, except that now this flux is summarizing the charge distribution from the outside of the region. So F and rho are completely independent quantities. They might be maybe the zero mode of F on the boundary is related to the zero mode of rho in the bulk in electromagnetism, for example. But otherwise, they are completely independent. I can fix any F given a rho just by arranging differently the charges outside or adding charges if I need. So rho and F are functionally independent, and this is the point I wanted to emphasize. So this way, the reason why so this Helmholtz decomposition works very well for both A and E, physically speaking, derives when it's not so easy to argue for this, but in the end, it turns out that that everything is nicely compatible because the Lagrangian is built out of these supermetric on field space and the principle of gauge invariance. So again, the Lagrangian of Young-Mills essentially derives from the same geometric ingredients that I'm using to build this Helmholtz decomposition. Okay, so here is, I've already gone through this point, but let me stress it again. So far I have sometimes used the expression gauge fixing. However, a gauge fixing would imply that we pick one section at least locally in configuration space, and that we throw away the rest of the information. So here we are not doing this in two different ways. So first, we're working only locally in configuration space, especially because we have in Young-Mills this distribution rather than a section. And second, we want to work covariantly in configuration space with respect to the background configurations. This is why we're not taking the just a transverse gluon, but a covariantly transverse gluon, perturbatively speaking, because we want to preserve the covariance, manifest covariance at every point of the calculation. So in this way, what we do is to separate the radiative part from the gauge Coulombic part of both A and E, but we don't throw away the gauge Coulombic part. We keep it. Because this information will actually be useful in the following. Okay, so, sorry. Okay, now that we have all these mathematics behind us, we can proceed and investigate the symplectic geometry. So answer what these quasi-local degrees of freedoms are. Again, remember we wanted to combine the geometry of fiber bundles. This gives us the connection, the Singer-DeWitt connection var pi, once we complete the information with the geometry of space and time. So now we want to put these two together and study the symplectic geometry. So the symplectic geometry of Young-Mills can be derived from, so this is just a quick preview without boundaries. So you take the Lagrangian, you write it in a more Hamiltonian or let's say velocity configuration space manner. So we have a dot that gives us, so the time derivative part, the kinetic term gives us the symplectic potential. And in this case is E delta A, just as simple as that. So these angular brackets are just the supermetric. So is the integral, I'm afraid. So here it is, the definition. In the blue box, this is the angular bracket equal to whatever is on the right-hand side. So this is the supermetric. Okay, sorry about this. So this is our symplectic potential, E delta A, as usual. And the symplectic form is just obtained by varying this theta, and is delta E delta A. Now, the neutral charges that we discussed before can be found very simply because this symplectic potential is gauge invariant. So its lead derivative in the gauge direction in field space vanishes, and this can be shown to give us automatically the Hamiltonian flow equation for discharge psi that is E d psi. So you don't have to follow the notation here. I'm not going to use it again. So it's just to show briefly which information we're using to define the neutral charges. And in fact, I want to do this because this identity, this invariance of the gauge potential under the vertical flows in the gauge direction is the fact that distinguishes Young-Mills from Trin-Simons theory very fundamentally. So what I will do later makes sense essentially because we have this equality and wouldn't make sense as much in Trin-Simons, although what we have done so far made sense also in the Trin-Simons theory. But our analysis for the symplectic structure will depend crucially on that equation, even though I will not go into the details why. So I will cut some corners and go directly to theta, the symplectic potential. Now we have E delta A, and we want to insert our definitions of what our Helmholtz decomposition. So we have E is the time derivative of the radiative mode plus the Coulombic mode. And similarly for delta A, we have the pure gauge part plus the radiative part. And since the Helmholtz decomposition is an orthogonal decomposition with respect to the same supermetric that I used to build the symplectic potential, everything factorizes nicely. And on shell of the Gauss constraint, we find, so here I'm not putting matter, not much would change in presence of matter, of course. So by introducing the Gauss constraint, we can write theta in this form. And we see that we have, just to stress again, there are no mixed term between radiative and Coulombic mode because the two are orthogonal to each other by construction, even at the boundary. So the first part here is the radiative part, which is horizontal, talks about objects living in these horizontal planes in the previous pictures of the fiber bundle. That's why it's called horizontal, is orthogonal to the fibers, which are thought as vertical. And then we have a vertical piece, which is the Coulombic part, which contains the electric flux and the pure gauge part of the connection. So these two pieces are functionally independent from each other. So the radiative part knows nothing about the electric flux and knows nothing about the Varpi, about the gauge component, and vice versa. One is a bulk object, and the other is a boundary object on shell of the Gauss constraint, of course. So this horizontal piece is gauge invariant, even for field-dependent gauge transformations. And this property is what we used a few years ago when we hadn't all this picture very clear yet, because, in fact, we were inspired by the work of William and Laurent about this, because this type of gauge invariance, even for field-dependent gauge transformation, was what pushed them to extend the phase space and so on. And now, what their new degrees of freedom formally plays the same role as Varpi here. Not the Varpi in the Coulombic piece, but there is a Varpi hidden in the definition of the of the radiative component. So formally, these two objects are very similar, but reinterpretation is quite different. But I wanted to emphasize this because in previous work, we were saying that this horizontal syntactic form was all there was. It wasn't quite right, but what was correct was that, we derived it by inspired by their work. And also importantly, the other fact that was emphasized by them is that something that satisfies this property that is completely gauge invariant also is always provides charges that vanish. So we are happy in a sense because on these radiative modes, there is they don't carry any gauge charge. They are manifestly gauge invariant. In our case, thanks to our choice of connection, it turns out that they can carry global charges. So the total electric charge would be carried by the radiative mode if matter is present. So this is the part that I will have to skip. And this is what I've just said. Okay. Now, this was about theta, but to fully understand the degrees of freedom, we should think about omega, the symplectic form. So by taking a variation of this expression and after some lengthy manipulation, we get to this expression. And the lengthy manipulations are needed to take out the time derivative from inside the delta to outside, which looks very trivial, but since everything is, these are not exact differential, things are more complicated. And to do that, we heavily use the connection form properties of RPi. So anyway, this aside, this is the functional connection form. And again, it has a radiative part, which is purely horizontal. It contains the transverse gluon and the Bress matter field when they're present. This is completely quasi-local, is a bulk piece, it's fully gauge invariant and including at the boundary. And in the presence of matter, as I said, it carries these global conserved charges. Now, in the Coulombic part is maybe in a way more interesting, is this boundary object. And we recognize that it's not purely vertical. It is mixed, at least it is mixed because F is a physical object, the flux, but VarPi is a pure gauge object. So the fact that these are conjugate to each other essentially tells us that an observable associated to the electric flux which is measurable from inside in a certain sense by approaching the boundary, commutes with all possible observables within the region because it's conjugate to a pure gauge quantity that is not observable. So in this sense, we claim that this formula shows that the electric flux should be superselected. And the other derivation of this fact that I'm aware of use either asymptotic arguments or lattice arguments. While in this case, it's completely done in the continuum and from a quasi-local perspective. In the non-abelian case, we have a second term in the Coulombic part, which is this VarPi wedge VarPi. And this is the part that leads to the non-commutativity of the electric flux and the flux quantization for example, in SU2 Young Mills. Okay. So now this concludes the discussion of the quasi-local degrees of freedom inside one given region with boundaries, and now we want to sew this region together. And by doing this, we will learn more about boundary degrees of freedom, as I will try to explain. So let me set up the question first. So we want to consider a bipartite system, M, given by two regions, R plus and R minus, their union, and they are glued along some interface S, which is not written here, but probably I would never use this letter. So So the question is whether do the gauge invariant degrees of freedom, and by gauge invariant here I should have written the radiative degrees of freedom within R plus and R minus, comprise all the gauge invariant degrees of freedom within M. So remember, before we have found that the degrees of freedom, we have radiative degrees of freedom and these Coulombic ones. The Coulombic ones are a little funny because they are, you have the electric flux, but it's conjugate to unphysical objects. So here the question is whether just by keeping the radiative degrees of freedom in both R plus and R minus, this contains all the needed information to recover all the gauge invariant observables in M. So forgetting about F and var pi, are the radiative parts enough? Is this true? Are they enough? Or there is an intrinsic ambiguity when gluing them? And so the crux of the difficulty of answering this question is the fact that everything is kind of non-local. And so the problem is not obvious a priori how it will work out. So let me set up this a bit more mathematically. So, and let me focus on the magnetic radiative degrees of freedom first. So the gauge potential. So here I will denote with a plus objects living in R plus and with a minus objects living within R minus. By definition, essentially, the global radiative field is given, is related to the local ones up to a regional gauge transformation. So these are these xi's, these capital xi's. So I call them gauge adjustments. The question is whether the regional gauge adjustments are uniquely and unambiguously determined by the regional radiative degrees of freedom. So knowing that the field will be continuous, because of course if things are non-continuous, we don't go anywhere, but knowing that the fields, the physical fields will be continuous, do the blue regional radiative degrees of freedom completely determine the gauge adjustments that we need to fix, to glue them together into a unique, well-defined global field? So again, I'm trying to ask whether I can fix uniquely the xi's given the radiative modes, the regional radiative modes. Because if I'm able to do this uniquely, then there is a unique global field associated to this radiative, regional radiative field. The answer is yes, we will be able to do so. However, we should be asking the following. Are there more degrees of freedom in M than in the disjoint union of R plus and R minus? So, okay, we have all the information to recover the degrees of freedom that we had, the global degrees of freedom, but is there somehow still some new degree of freedom popping out from this construction? And a bit counterintuitively, the answer will be again, yes. So it's kind of subtle how these two questions are related to each other, but and distinct. Okay, so this is what I want to convince you in the rest of the talk. This is the statement of the theorem, and let's see how it works out. So these xi's turn out that they have to satisfy are uniquely determined by this boundary value problem. So let me unpack this. So let's focus on the boundary value problem itself. So it's one of the usual kind that we have seen, a covariant Neumann Laplace equation, where the Neumann boundary condition pi is fixed in terms of the radiative modes. So let's go step by step. Let's see which ingredients are entering here. So these R's are the Dirichlet to Neumann pseudo-differential operators, or sometimes they're called Poisson kernels, and they are self-adjoint and positive on the boundary. So geometrically, in a sense, they depend on the bulk of the region, but they are pseudo-differential operators acting on functions intrinsic to the boundary, to the interfaces. So this is this object that allows us to change. So what is a Dirichlet to Neumann operator is something that allows to, given any a solution of a Laplace equation with the given boundary conditions, allows us to translate from a Dirichlet condition to a Neumann condition. So this is how they are defined. Next, we have this object. So this inverse Laplacian applied to a divergence. And we recognize that this is the this operator is the boundary analog of VARPi itself. So VARPi was defined for the bulk, but here this green function, this complicated operator, is essentially an Helmholtz projector on the boundary longitudinal part of whatever follows, and is again completely intrinsic to the boundary. And finally, we have this object, which is the protagonist of this story, which is the radiative mismatch at the interface. And this mismatch is what I will argue to be the new boundary degree of freedom. So to simplify things later on, let me introduce this notation, mu delta A. Mu stands for mismatch, so it's easy to remember. So when you see the mu, is this complicated functional of the mismatch. The only thing we care about is that it represents the mismatch. So let me just say one word about the mismatch, though. So the mismatch, I didn't write the pullback, but it should be, is we take the radiative modes in either region, we pull them back on the boundary, and we take the difference. This is the mismatch. I forgot to write the pullback to the boundary. Okay, so let's see what, so this is the end of the story for the magnetic part. So let's focus now on the electric part. The story is very similar because it all depends on the properties of our Helmholtz decomposition, except that now the Coulombic pieces are also physical. So to simplify things, let's take the case in which we have no charges. There is no electric charge sitting around. So the global Coulombic field will be zero. However, since although there is no charge, the regional Coulombic piece are sourced also by the flux across the boundary, there might be some flux across the interface, even if there is no charge sitting around. So the phi plus and minus are non-zero, but phi is zero, and they're sourced by F. So the reconstruction that I showed before, the Sewing theorem, now tells us that the electric flux F through the boundary is not locally encoded in the mismatch of the electric radiative modes. Okay. And this leads us directly to to a Sewing inequality. So to express it, let's introduce the energy. This is a local functional of completely gauge invariant. So we have the electric piece plus the magnetic contribution, which I want to split into a radiative part and the Coulombic part. Of course, the magnetic part is always purely radiative and local. There is no issue with it, but E, being split into Coulombic and radiative piece, separates the two. Now, it turns out that upon Sewing, using the equations that I've shown in the previous slides, it turns out that the radiative contribution to the energy is always bigger in the biggest region, in the larger region, than the smaller ones. And this follows from the fact, in these, there is a simple case in which one can see it immediately, is the one that I was mentioning before. If there is no charge and phi, the global phi is zero, there will be no Coulombic energy on one side, but there will be some in the sub, when I think of it in the subregions. Okay, so this this fact that is fairly easy to see, at least in this case where there are no charges, in fact hints to the fact that there are new radiative degrees of freedom that emerge upon gluing, since the energy is a positive function of the number of degrees of freedom somehow, that there should be more degrees of freedom in the bigger region. So this is the hint, and now we want to see if this is true by looking at the symplectic form. So now, whereas omega is trivially additive upon sewing, simply because it contains both the gauge part, the flux, everything, the radiative part of the symplectic form is not. So I could have written the same about it. In fact, I will use theta because it has a simpler expression. So the radiative part on the union of the regions is not the sum of the radiative parts. There is an extra non-local contribution, which is function of the radiative mismatch at the interface. And this is the formula. So we have radiative in region R plus, radiative in regions R minus, plus a new boundary term. But the boundary piece is a little misleading because everything, all these operators are kind of non-local. And so although, well, they're not really, if you think in terms of the original variables, they're very non-local, but they're all intrinsic to the boundary because the mu is one of these Helmholtz projectors intrinsic to the boundaries. And then we have these Poisson kernels, these Dirichlet-Neumann operators appearing. And we see that we have the here on the right, the radiative modes, delta of the radiative modes, and here we have the mismatch of their electric counterparts, so their time derivatives. And in between there is these Poisson kernels. So we see that the new radiative degrees of freedom are generated by the mismatch between the regional radiative degrees of freedom at the interface. And the interesting, so what I want to stress is that although the radiative modes exist in each region, this mismatch doesn't exist in any of the two. Is a coupling between the two, and this coupling is new. It doesn't exist within any of the two regions, and is exactly what the electric flux was supposed to summarize for us. So now that we have both regions and we can compare the mismatch at the boundary, this mismatch will be our new degree of freedom. So this is proper of Young-Mills theories. This formula holds only for Young-Mills theories. In the abelian case, we can write a similar formula for omega quite simply because all these Dirichlet-Neumann operators and mu projectors, Helmholtz projectors, are field independent. And so the delta can go in and out of them. There is no issue. And so it's quite easy to, we can just write it like this. It wouldn't be, in Young-Mills, it would be quite complicated to compute omega explicitly. Okay, so to summarize, we have reformulated the problem of understanding non-locality in Young-Mills theory in terms of the cutting and sewing problem. So for the cutting part, what we did was to split the Young-Mills degrees of freedom into radiative degrees of freedom. They are finite boundary generalization of the covariantly transverse gluons and Coulombic degrees of freedom, which essentially are given by the electric flux through the boundary. And these are needed to determine the regional physics because, of course, the electric field has a Coulombic component that is also gauge invariant and is important for the dynamics of charges and so on. This degree of freedom, this electric flux, can be understood as summarizing what we need to know within our region about the outside world to completely compute the physics, solve the physics inside R. In the presence of matter, the radiative degrees of freedom, despite being gauge invariant, they still carry global symmetry. So the total electric charge would be included into, will be the only charge carried by these modes. And this would be what lies in the next section, which I not have the time to discuss unless I get questions on that. And finally, we have the Coulombic degrees of freedom that are this mixed pair that explains the superselection and the non-commutativity of the electric flux. In the sewing part of the talk, what I've tried to convey is the following, that upon sewing the electric flux through the interface constitutes redundant information. So the regional radiative degrees of freedom contain all the information needed to reconstruct the sewn configuration. Still, this does not mean that the radiative modes simply factorize over subregions. In fact, upon sewing, new radiative modes emerge, which are non-locally determined by the mismatch between the regional radiative degrees of freedom at the interface. The mismatch is encoded in the regional radiative modes, but is not a regional piece of information itself. Like the electric flux, the mismatch is the signature of the non-locality of Young-Mills theory. Just a technical note to conclude, all the results descended simply from the definition of the single, all the technicalities descending from this single equation, and in particular from the boundary conditions, this particular boundary condition that appears. I've also hidden the role of the connection form in this discussion using this delta slash notation. However, recognizing the role of the Singer-DeWitt connection and its covariant properties is absolutely crucial, not only to swiftly perform the needed calculations, but also to inform us how to organize some complex expressions. If we were to work with gauge fixed quantities and using Green's function, we would just go crazy. The fact that we know which geometric properties VarPi satisfies allows us to do these computations. The abelian case is simple, doesn't require that, but the non-abelian one is a different story. Working at the level of gauge fixings and Green function would be extremely cumbersome. So really, the convergence of these type of geometries is indeed fundamental to the results of this work. So this would be the last section, but I will stop here. And thank you for your attention.
All right, thanks. Aldo? And so let's start with questions from students and postdoc first. So, anyone? Okay, so if there are no questions from the students, then we can move on with the rest of the crowd.
This is Carlo. Aldo.
Hi, Carlo.
Just an extremely general question, I suppose. This is sort of very enlightening. It brings together it answers a number of confusion or lack of clarity one has. It puts the dots on the I. It makes everything stay together coherently. The obvious question at the end of a talk like that is that's wonderful, beautiful, very beautiful. But what do we do with that? So what is the useful lesson that one takes home, besides two obvious things, which is confirming the philosophy you started from on the one hand, and on the other hand, giving a global mathematical framework in which everything goes together, which is beautiful. But I for a sort of a mechanician like myself who wants to use mathematical physics for doing physics and for doing stuff, What is the take home story here?
Okay, so I think that having one unique framework that puts together so many ingredients, and there are others that I didn't have the time to mention, is actually, I hope it can spur new understandings and new techniques that not only streamline previous computations, but allow us to do new ones. For example, I think it kind of quite clarifies quite a lot what was happening in Wilkowiecki's and DeWitt definition of the effective action, which is a useful computational tool in the case of gauge theories. But at a deeper level, I think, so for me, this work is just preliminary to understand how to deal with gravity in finite regions. And there, the questions are even more complicated and even more confusing. So I find having these solid background for young Mills is extremely important. And we want to be able to understand boundaries in gravity for all the usual reasons, because these transition amplitudes are kind of necessarily associated to finite regions. So they're most naturally built in this context. So we need to have a solid grasp of what is going on. And so that was my original motivation that I didn't mention. And then I think there are some potentially, I hope, other things that come out. For example, what I'm doing now is to apply these formulas to the computation of the entanglement entropy for gauge theories, trying to clarify what is this contact term, how to think of it from this perspective. And that's, for people working in holography, that's interesting in itself. And finally, I came across another set of problems that people are interested in, which I don't know if this will have something to say to can help them, but it might. And so the problem is the following. Defining angular momentum is quite tricky in gauge theories, and well, in gravity is even more, but let's stick to gauge theories. And the reason is that the interplay between gauge and the rotations, which are diffeomorphism, is not all that nice. The two kind of hit each other, and then one gets boundary terms, and experimentalists are interested into knowing which piece is an intrinsic angular momentum, which piece is an orbital angular momentum. And then what they usually do is to throw away boundary terms. But interestingly enough, in a paper of a few years ago, people were emphasizing how throwing away boundary terms when you have a detector hit by the light is probably not the best of the ideas. And so they were discussing this issue and providing new formulas, which can be totally understood in terms of what we did here. And more interestingly, just one last thing, is what happens in QCD. So in QCD, there is something that is called the proton angular momentum. And basically, it's very hard to account for the spin of the proton from its constituents. And I don't know if this can help, but again, similar techniques, these Helmholtz decompositions have been used there, and maybe having more refined tools can also help.
Nice. And with respect to your second answer, namely general relativity, this construction that you have, which is, as far as I see, for young Mills, is sort of complete, right? It's.
Yeah, I would say.
I mean, I don't know if you have hidden something, but it's all clear. It's just, wow. How far are you for having same thing for GR? Is that something coming, or do you see some huge stumbling blocks? Or
I didn't spend even enough time to have clear answers on this. What I've been seeing by preliminary computations is that things are quite more complicated. For example, the elliptic equations that come out are maybe not even clearly elliptic in the general case. So about the uniqueness of solutions and so on is, I think, a lot of has to be understood. And what I've learned, so these sound like very technical details, but what I've learned by doing these is that the non-uniqueness of whatever I've encountered here usually has a physical meaning. Yes. So my boundary value problem has not unique solutions in certain circumstances. And this is because there are global charges and so on. So cutting the corners is not necessary. Can give you a rough idea of what's going on, but you might be losing lots of valuable information. The meat, in a sense. An extra difficulty that is more subtle is, okay, so there are two types of problems with gravity. One is that is more complicated just algebraically, and the other is the fact that diffeomorphisms can be transverse to the boundary or to the hypersurface. So those transverse to the hypersurface are extremely complicated. I don't know what this can tell us about them. Those transverse to the boundaries, on the other hand, I think we can have a good grasp on them through this formalism.
Last question, if the chair allows me. You, at the beginning, you said thinking in terms of a lattice sort of misleads. I've always tried to think in terms of a lattice, so that worried me. I take your word for it. I believe you, but
I have exactly the same question.
So the reason is the following. So if we glue. So, for example, at a very superficial level, we have that we need to invert all these Laplacians. And of course, we can do that because I'm assuming a smooth space-time underneath. Now, things become more complicated in the presence of non-trivial topology because I can have, for example, if I start from a line and I glue it back into a circle, I can still apply this formalism, but there is a genuinely new degree of freedom that emerges, and it emerges naturally in the formalism, but it has to be accounted for separately, which is the Aronov bohm phase. So on a lattice, all that you're finding is Aronov bohm phases everywhere. So in a sense, I'm not saying that the two are completely incompatible, but definitely will require separate ways of thinking, and maybe, and the continuum limit is absolutely not obvious, which is something that we know from loop quantum gravity as well, that the continuum limit, whatever that means, is not that obvious. But here, from the gauge perspective, the main reason is the fact that on the continuum, I'm inverting Laplacians all the time. And whenever I have a complicated topology, I have to account for Aronov bohm phases. And these are the things that we naturally add at the end of the open edges, if you want. But I don't have to do it in my examples, because the topology is trivial and everything is smooth and so on. So it's subtle to, I think, yeah, those are the two reasons, I would say.
Yeah, okay. Can I continue on that?
Yeah, sure.
Because it goes back, would you just say that you don't have to add, so, let me back up. I mean, I think there is already today a notion of what is in the continuum, the end of the edges. So I don't think there's really a tension in terms of.
I should have prepared this slide because I don't have a blackboard. But if doing in the continuum what you can do on the edges is, of course, at least I would say, is your formulation with William, because if you add these G minus one delta Gs, they are the continuum version of what one does on the lattice. I totally agree with that, if it's what you mean. The point is, maybe I can add it here, is that these would if I did it in this formalism, I mean, of course, here I've done not in this formula for theta, I've done nothing. I've just rewritten things. So I can take your construction and apply it on top of whatever I've done. If I do it, what I find is that instead of my var pi, I find var pi minus g minus 1 delta g. And then I can do it, and I can start thinking about what that means. It seems to me that from this formulation, in this context, this is something redundant that is not really needed. I never felt the need to add that term in going through my analysis, which doesn't mean that it cannot be reinterpreted and used for something good. But it wasn't a necessary step to take. So of course I would have to enlarge my field space and add a new term there and have to, I don't know, analyze what comes out. It can definitely be done.
I mean, this is what you say in the beginning. Like there is a boundary term, you call it psi at some point in your thing. And then what you do later is that you want to relate that edge mode mod to the bulk one by adding an extra condition.
I don't add any extra conditions.
Well,
what I was claiming before is that this psi appear because I'm not using a complete gauge fixing.
From my perspective, I can embed what you're doing from the bigger perspective of the extended, where essentially you add an extra condition, which is that the normal derivative of omega slash is ni ai. So there's a way to relate. So
no, I'm telling you what adding your boundary terms would do to this. We just add here in the red box an extra term, which is f g minus 1 delta g.
I don't think that's really what I'm talking about. But later, anyway, so if you have only one boundary, you might decide to gauge fix in one way or the other these boundary modes. But as you see later, and I'm happy that now you're seeing it, is that when you start to glue regions, this is where, so it's really when you have the gluing of regions that you need and you see the presence of additional degrees of freedom.
Yeah, but I'm not modding out anything. I have added nothing and I don't have to remove anything. These degrees of freedom, I can identify them in terms of gauge invariant quantities in the bulk of the regions, which are these guys.
If you want, but you have that there's more degrees of freedom when you
or better this.
No, you had after. You have to add something to this.
No. I say that. So I made the distinction. I have before gluing, I have all the information, but I'm missing some degrees of freedom. And these degrees of freedom are these mismatches.
Yeah, you're missing.
This is the.
That's the point. Yeah. So we agree on that.
I think at this level of generality, yes. At the level of what one needs to do technically to see these, I think it's not that we disagree. We take different routes maybe, but I find way more minimal and I don't know. I've never seen this formula in terms of the mismatches. This is new. And I think it's as explicit as it can get. And that's my contribution to the discussion. And then if one wants to embed it into another framework, I'm happy to see and to work on extensions of these or anything, but this is just a result. I don't know.
But I would say that's one of the main, I mean, this is the reason why people are interested in that. There is new degrees of freedom that you...
Yeah, no, I agree. I think this clarifies what they are.
Well, that's one way to do it in Europe, but there's other ways to do it. The question of minimality could be discussed.
Okay, well.
But the important thing is that there are new degrees of freedom and you want to be able to track mm-hmm. them.
Yeah, I agree.
Understand how they commute and how they affect yes. physics.
Yes, that's for sure. 100%.
Hello, Arnon.
Hi.
This is Seth. I have a question.
Oh, hi, Seth.
So when you started, you mentioned a disclaimer about distinguishing between physical boundaries and your fiducial boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, so if you rather have a physical boundary, would you need to add some more details, boundary conditions, or like what do you have to do?
Yeah, for example, a typical thing would be to have a boundary in at which, I don't know, the electric flux vanishes. That would be, if I remember my electromagnetism well enough, that is a conducting plate, an ideal conducting boundary plate. And this I can just implement on top of what I have. I can just say, here F should be zero and there is no delta F possible or something like that. And still I would have my photons and so on. Maybe there are extra boundary conditions on the photons too that I should implement. I should think about it. But the idea is that this is covering all phase space. And then if you add the boundary conditions, you're restricting what something that is already, so I'm not throwing away anything. That's the only thing I wanted to say. I'm not imposing specific boundary conditions at any moment. And so whatever boundary conditions, you can impose it on top of what is here.
Okay. And also the new boundary degrees of freedom you get, is it local?
Sorry?
It wasn't clear to me. Do you get like a local?
Local? Okay. So let me, there are two things to take into account. One is how I extract the radiative information within one region. To do this, I need to solve these this equation that looks like this. So I need to solve this equation for bar pi. And this is an unlocal equation for, so you see the radiative mode down here at this level is defined in terms of var pi. So var pi is non-locally constructing within each region. Now, once you have this quantity, or once you have this quantity, you can, in a sense, this is kind of cheating because you're trying to extract from something redundant, something minimal. So you can also say the radiative modes are local. In some sense, they are your photon is sitting somewhere. So from that perspective, so there I allow you some wiggle room to decide whether that's local or non-local. But once you have those, you go back here and you see that these mismatches are built intrinsically to the boundary. So you compute this difference, the difference of the pullbacks, and then you apply a non-local operator to them, but this non-local operator is intrinsic to the boundary. So is, in a sense, is an operation which is localized at the boundary, but non-local within the boundary. Mm. Finally, last piece of non-locality that appears is these Poisson kernels. So the Poisson kernels are differential operators on the boundary that act on boundary functions for the geometry of the region inside. So it's kind of a complicated structure. And I'm not sure how to answer that question briefly. It's just, there are many ingredients with different roles.
Yeah, thank you for the nice talk.
Yeah.
Right, do we have more questions?
I have another question.
Hi, Bolton.
Hi, Aldo. So if you glue two regions again together, is it that all fields will be continuous across the boundary?
Yeah, that's a requirement. It's an hypothesis, yes. No, it's an hypothesis. I demand continuity.
So there are no flashes of light that would go along the boundary? Distributional sources or distributional solutions?
So that's a good question. I don't know about distributional photons. Maybe not. I think they are disallowed. But I should look more in detail. I have the precise conditions written down. I think some sort of discontinuity might be possible kinematically, but not any kind. So definitely I have in mind that the normal part of the magnetic field to the boundary has to be continuous, 100%. So maybe the tangential part could not. I'm not fully sure. Like this, it's not super easy to see from the formulas. One should unpack them.
Thanks.
But in general, I was assuming for simplicity continuity.
Okay.
Also, if it's discontinuous, for example, your electric flux is discontinuous, then you're having a density charge sitting there, and so it's kind of outside.
I was just thinking of a shockwave of light.
Yeah, exactly. Those I don't know. I'm not sure. I would say since B has to be continuous and the shockwave probably has B, yeah, I don't know what kind of field it has. But yeah.
Okay. So more questions? Okay, if not, then let's thank Aldo again.
Thank you, Daniela.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Have a good afternoon, everyone.
Bye-bye. Ciao, Aldo.
Ciao.